You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be looking at Greece's attempts to untarnish their image with a new ad campaign, Give Greece a Chance.
We believe that this is the time that people should be looking to in Greece invest, because there's a lot of opportunities.
And we'll also be meeting the neighbours of Midori House. Today we head out to the local fish and chip shop, founded in 1914.
There's a lot of fish and chips in the UK, in London. There's not many left in central London, simply because a lot of them don't know how to do it properly.
And we'll be finishing up this week's celebrations of Monocle by looking at our newest venture, Monocle 24. We'll be joined in the studio by two of the show's producers. We'll also be looking at the past year of Monocle magazine to see how it's evolved. And we'll be highlighting some of our favourite stories. All that, plus some great music as well, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, let's get the news from around the world with Georgina Godwin.
Violence continued in the Syrian city of Homs today as a meeting of the Friends of Syria group got underway in Tunisia. It's been attended by European and Arab League foreign ministers and the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The Saudi foreign minister has walked out of the meeting after saying that focusing on humanitarian aid to Syria was not enough. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, said it was negotiating with Syrian officials and opposition forces in Homs and was insisting on evacuating all sick and wounded in need of assistance. Meanwhile, new footage has been obtained by Reuters showing French photographer Remy Oschlik laughing and sitting with a group of Syrian Free Army fighters before falling victim to a shelling attack in Homs. The photographer's surviving colleague, Paul Conroy, was also filmed, recalling the moments after the fatal attack.
I don't really remember much after that. There were a couple of close hits, and then we took a direct hit somewhere. I was injured in the leg. I think my colleague Marie Colvin is dead, and Remy also is dead, as far as I know.
12 people have been killed in protests in Afghanistan over the burning of copies of the Quran at a NATO military base. Armed protesters killed one demonstrator in the east of the city. It's not clear who fired the shots that killed a second protester in another Kabul rally. 7 more protesters were killed in the western province of Herat, 2 more in eastern Khost province, and 1 in the relatively peaceful northern Baghlan province. In Herat, around 500 men charged at the US consulate. It's the 4th day of protests in the country since the burning of the Qurans at the Bagram compound earlier this week. In Somalia, a missile strike has killed 4 foreign Islamist militants south of the capital, a day after the country's prime minister called for foreign airstrikes against the Al-Shabaab rebel group. The Al-Qaeda-backed militants confirmed a missile strike, but said it was not clear if the dead were its fighters or civilians. Somalis regularly report drones and warplanes flying overhead. While the United States never comments officially on drone strikes in Somalia, Washington has authorized covert operations in the Horn of Africa nation in the past. At a London conference yesterday aimed at energizing attempts to end more than 20 years of anarchy in Somalia, US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said airstrikes on areas of Somalia controlled by Al-Shabaab would not be a good idea. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard has defended her leadership of the country in a race to find a new leader of the Labour Party. Gillard has called for a vote on who leads the party to try to stop a bitter leadership fight engulfing the minority government.
The choice that the nation faces and my parliamentary colleagues face on Monday is a choice as to who has got the character, the temperament, the strength to deliver on behalf of the Australian people.
Meanwhile, Australia's former Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd said he will now fight for the leadership. He was ousted by Gillard in June 2010. And staying in Australia, an inquest began hearing new evidence today into the 1980 death of baby Azaria Chamberlain, a case that's haunted Australia for decades and drew international attention after her parents said she'd been killed by a dingo or wild dog. This, the fourth inquest, is in response to new information provided by the parents of the dead child. They expect the court to declare officially that Azaria was killed by a dingo rather than by her mother, Lindy Chamberlain. And those are the main stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Georgina. Now, just looking at the front pages as they come in from the Asia-Pacific region, the Saturday Age, dominated by the divide in the Labour Party, Rudd and Gillard. People in the majority seem to prefer Rudd, 58%, against Gillard's 34%, but less sure as to whether or not the party needs a switch of leadership. 48% would like to see a switch to Rudd, 47% would like to see it stay with Gillard. Look at New Zealand's Weekend Herald. They go quite prominently with calls for Sir Douglas Graham to lose his knighthood. This is, of course, in reference to the collapse of Lombard Finance after Sir Douglas was found guilty of making false statements about the company's position just before its collapse. He was found guilty along with two other men. And it has an interview with one of the company's investors who lost six-figure sums, his life savings, a Paul Waugh, who's quoted as saying, "My fondest wish would be to see those guys on bread and water for a few years." And the paper also makes comparisons between Sir Douglas Graham and Sir Fred Goodwin of the UK, who was the former chief executive of the Royal Bank of Scotland. He lost his knighthood after what happened to RBS. And just looking at the Weekend Press of New Zealand, is a nice picture of children get heartfelt presents. Pupils at Freeville School in New Brighton, which was badly damaged by the Christchurch earthquake, have been sent hearts and wishes from fellow school children around the world, come from as far as Finland, Denmark, Australia, the UK and the US. I think we'll get the world weather now with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And it's a mild end to the business week across Western Europe. Yesterday in the UK, we had unusually warm weather. For the end of February, 19 degrees in Birmingham, a near record. The coming weekend will remain fairly mild in the west, but the weather will be a little mixed. We have a lot of cloud, perhaps a bit of rain in some of the major cities. Next week, however, is looking much sunnier with great weather in the Alps. So here's the weekend city outlook. In London, 12 degrees and partly cloudy. Vienna, 10 Celsius, also partly cloudy. In Barcelona, a warm 18 with sunshine. In Warsaw, only 2 degrees, cloudy with a light rain and snow mix. Over to North America, and snow has hit the upper Midwest and New England in the past 24 hours. Some delays at O'Hare Airport. The wintry weather is expected to last into early Saturday, but come Sunday, the sun should be back out again, and the start of next week is also looking sunny in cities like New York. So, on to the weekend city outlook. In Chicago, 4 degrees and sunny. New York City, 7, with some sunshine too. In Miami, 26, sunshine and thunder showers. LA, 21 and sunny skies. And now other world locations around the world. Let's have a look at the Caribbean. It's the quiet, dry season right now. In Nassau in the Bahamas, 24 degrees, just a few clouds. The British Virgin Islands, 25 degrees, dry weather too, little cloud, and the water temperature is around 26. In South Africa, in Johannesburg, 26 degrees with frequent thunder showers, and that should last right through the weekend. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomas. It's 8 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Tomatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Christian Yeo. Now, Greece may have been saved from bankruptcy by a second bailout this week, but its reputation, its image, its appeal amongst tourists enjoyed no such rescue. With images of firebombings in central Athens still fresh in people's minds, the Greeks have launched PR initiatives to clean the slate and re-establish their homeland status, albeit a more humble one. In newspapers around the world on Friday, an ambitious ad campaign funded funded by a business group, which included Aegean Air and Piraeus Bank, asked the world to give Greece a chance. A little earlier, I spoke to the Greek tourism minister, Panos Yeroulanos, and I started by asking him, a chance to do what exactly?
As you well know, the past few months have been quite devastating for the image of Greece. The way that Greece and Greeks have been portrayed in the media has been, I would say, rather extreme. I'm not arguing whether how much of that is fair or not, but the reality is that we have a lot of damage control to do. And while negative articles are being written about you, it's very difficult to do advertising to reverse that. But I think the worst is now over. There's a new agreement on the table. The agreement has been passed by the Greek Parliament. And we do believe that this is the beginning of a new period. And in this new period, what we're called to do is we're called to grow the Greek economy through our own means. And that will require a change of attitude all around from us and from the people who hear us from abroad. And I believe in that spirit, both the private sector and the public sector will be doing campaigns to try to balance a little bit of the image that has come out in the past.
Certainly in your remit as tourism minister, you'll be looking to get people from other parts of the Eurozone to visit Greece again in the summer. How are you going to entice people back to Greece and erase those images of rioting that they saw in Athens and Saloniki?
Well, actually, last year we had a record year. We had the biggest growth in a while, and the numbers that we received in terms of visitors was unprecedented, which shows that despite the crisis and despite the images that are coming out of Greece, people are trusting Greece to spend their vacation because they know that these events are very isolated and that the beauty of Greece remains as they know it. In fact, they feel, and rightly so, that Greece has some very good opportunities right now for very competitive prices. People have been coming to Greece despite the difficulties. We do, however, feel that the next year will need an extra effort on a variety of levels. First of all, while this is going on, we see that there's a cautiousness from our traditional markets. We have tremendous growth in the newer markets, but our traditional markets, such as England and Germany, are more cautious. We would like to explain to people that there's no reason to be cautious. Greece is still a very peaceful place and a place where very little violence takes place and that what you see is very isolated. But there's also another element here that I think is very important. Greece is going into a new phase and we'd like to see this in a very optimistic manner. The only area that has suffered through this process has been Athens. The city of Athens, and that's a really pity because Athens is a wonderful tourist destination, and unfortunately right now, while we've had 10% growth all over Greece, we've had a 3% decrease in Athens, and we think that's unfair for the city, which has a lot to offer.
As a place to do business, though, it doesn't appear to be a good time to strike up deals. It's a tough time. Austerity measures are going to make that harder, aren't they?
No, actually, we believe that this is the time that people should be looking to in Greece to invest because there's a lot of opportunities. What we have had to do in the past, and that has been a cause of unrest, was to make the Greek economy competitive. And among the things we've had to do is lower basic wages. And that, of course, has had tremendous social unrest, and rightly so. But that's not the only thing we're doing. We're simplifying the process by which you can start a company. We're making it more. We're making the whole environment more prone to foreign direct investment, and there's a lot of interest for investments in tourism. The tourism sector has been growing, and foreigners are looking into tourism in order to invest, and we would like to help them do that.
How do you think the press coverage has been about Greece? There have been accusations that the media has stirred up the tensions between Greece and other countries in the Eurozone and vilified Greece. And now this business group behind these ads has effectively chucked money at those newspapers and thinks that buying ad space is the answer. They're not hoping for a toning down, say, of the coverage that Greece gets in the future?
I'm not sure of what is their side motivations except to get that message across. The reality is that while you have stories against you, and there have been plenty of stories against you, it is very difficult to build a different image. You have to let this feeding frenzy die out first, and then start building anew. I think this is a great opportunity for Greece to start showing up a much more current image, an image that says, this is who we really are. These are the people that will produce the change that's needed in Greece, and to give a different image of Greece, which is based on the value of its people, which, frankly speaking, is Greece's number one asset.
There was a war of words in recent months between Greece and Germany, and is there a risk that that sentiment will filter down from the people in power, and that bad feeling towards the likes of Angela Merkel will translate into a bad reception for German tourists, say, in the summer?
Absolutely. We see that AAA countries, strangely enough, or not strangely enough, are the countries that are where most negative feelings have arisen about Greece. Countries, for example, whose debt is on the highest level, feel that they are paying an unjust price by helping Greece out. The reality is that they're going to get paid that money in total with interest, and there is no reason for the sentiment. I know people are helping Greece, and we're very grateful for that. But the reality is that no one is going to lose their money here, and this is a plan that has been put together by the European Union and Greece. And we're looking forward to changing that sentiment. It's an unjust sentiment. We understand why it happens, but now Greece needs to voice its voice and its opinion, and to try to change these sentiments. Because, as I said before, Greece is not what it has been portrayed these days. The images of negativity far surpass the problems that the country has, and there has been a quieting down of all the beauty that it has to offer.
Germany is a very important country. It's one of your most important in terms of tourism. Does this mean that the ads that we're seeing today in the English-speaking papers will also be featuring in Germany as well? Will you be making a concerted effort there?
Certainly from the part of the government. I can't speak for the businessmen who have been financing this campaign, but the government will be addressing the issues in Germany as well. And we think that that is very important because England and Germany are our biggest market. We really need to get these visitors to our country. We really need to explain our story, admit to our mistakes, but also show the things that we're doing well. And frankly speaking, the second part has not been addressed at all by the media, and we need to rebalance that. Anybody who has come to Greece knows that Greece is a tremendously peaceful country, a very welcoming country. And we want to show that. Just recently, I had 19 Israeli tour operators who came to Greece, and they said, you know what, we've gone the whole world round, and this is the only place when we had to leave, people hugged us and said goodbye to us. That is the kind of imagery that we want coming out of Greece, the feeling of friendship and of welcoming that visitors all over the world want to feel.
When you're looking at how to market Greece to the world as a tourist destination, traditionally it was seen as a place that you could get great beauty for great value, and the euro did seem to change that, and it made Greece unaffordable compared to some newer destinations that became fashionable to travel to. How can you steer the focus now? Are you going to have to shift it up market? And you can't compete on price with the newer destinations, can you?
First of all, Greece has been rather competitive with the prices that it has been offering. We reduced VAT taxes to in order to expand and promote Greece, and the hoteliers passed this reduction VAT to their prices. That made Greece quite competitive last summer, and it will be very competitive this summer as well. So people need to look into the prices that are being offered. In general, however, I would say that Greece has every reason to look, to start looking up market. It has a lot to offer. Its cultural background is, and the beauty of its nature is such that it would absolutely justify looking at clients which want a very unique experience, and they're willing to pay for it.
That was Panos Yeronanos, the tourism minister for Greece. You can hear more about the future of the Greek brand tonight on the Monocle Daily, where we'll be running the final report of a five-part series from Athens. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be playing some music after this.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you beautifully shot stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus our regular Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel, food and retail. Premiering this week, novel ideas from Japan.
In the city known to offer the newest and most inventive concepts, Tokyo does it again with Tsutaya Books, a new kind of third space, somewhere that's neither home nor work, and much needed in this dense city.
This and over 250 more films broadcasting on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now it's time for some music, and this is I Got Somebody New by George Levin. That was I Got Somebody New by George Levin. You're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24. Every week at Monocle, we like to go out and meet the neighbours to get to know some of the thriving local businesses which surround Midori House. This week, we went to the home of a firm culinary favourite, our local fish and chip shop. The Golden Hind started in 1914. We went down to have a look and spoke with the owner, Anthony Crystal.
My name is Tony Crystal. It's actually Anthony Christou, but people call me Tony. I come from Cyprus. I came here when I was 17 years old. I've been living in London since. I've been in various kind of businesses. This is my first catering business, the Golden Hind. And I've been here approximately 10 years now. This is it. The shop opened in 1914. It's almost 100 years now. It was opened by an Italian. His name was Esposito. And then there's another two Italians after him. The previous owner, which I bought it from, was from Greece, Salonika, Greece. And as I said, I bought it about 10 years ago. It's traditionally British fish and chips. We just specialize on that, you know. The name comes from Sir Francis Drake. He was in charge of the naval force of UK in those days. You know, when they were fighting the Spanish Armada, you know. And that's why it's got the name Golden Hind, from Sir Francis Drake. In fact, the boat is somewhere down the Thames, I think, you know, they recovered it, and it's been destroyed completely, but they had a replica on it, which is somewhere down the Maritime Museum in Greenwich, I believe. That's why I got the name from that boat. But traditionally, our customers are the regular customers from London. Basically, we got two types of different customers. One, lunchtime is mainly offices, shops, hotels. They send people around to us. In the evening, it's more different. You got more tourists. You get people who from all over London, local people who live in the area. Some people come in every week, regularly, on a specific date, you know. But, our tourist base is basically, if you take Italian, Spanish, a lot of French the last couple of years, Belgium, Holland. Another big influx is from the United States, from Canada, and the last couple of years from Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, you know, those places. So basically we get people from all over the world, you know. Some countries we get more than others. But even China now, we get a lot of people from China the last 6 months. And also all the other European countries. But from the European countries, predominantly it's been France, Italy, Spain, Belgium and Holland. There's a lot of fish and chips in the UK, in London. There's not many left in central London, simply because two things. People who started it, they're gone. A lot of them don't know how to do it properly. They try to cut corners. I'm not saying purposely, possibly because they don't know any different. Also, because of the rents, expenses in the West End are very, very high. But it's also, it's an easy to prepare in a way, but difficult to get it right, you know. And you have to be really, how can I put it? It's got to be in you to want to do it properly, you know. And that's me, I have to be perfectionist, you know. So I try to improve, although I'm very, very busy, I try to improve every time my quality, my service, hygiene in the restaurant, and basically those things are very important, you know.
That was Anthony Christou from the Golden Hind. You're listening to Midori House.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be discussing Monocle's newest venture, M24. But first, here's Georgina Godwin with the news headlines.
Foreign powers are turning a blind eye to weapons purchased by Syrian exiles who are already smuggling light arms, communications equipment and night vision goggles to rebels inside Syria, an opposition force said today. A meeting of the Friends of Syria, attended by foreign ministers, is taking place in Tunisia, where the Red Cross has said it is negotiating with Syrian officials and opposition forces to evacuate the sick and wounded from Homs. 12 people were killed on Friday in the bloodiest day yet in protests that have raged across Afghanistan over the desecration of copies of the Muslim holy book at a NATO military base, with riot police and soldiers on high alert, braced for more violence. In Moscow, Vladimir Putin will reclaim the Kremlin's top job by winning 2/3 of the vote in a March presidential election. But Russia's leader may face growing resentment against his rule, the last major poll before the vote showed today. Greece took its first step towards reaping urgently needed funds agreed in a €130 billion rescue package as its parliament endorsed a bond swap for private holders of its debt. And in Canberra, Kevin Rudd, who stepped down as Australia's foreign minister this week, said he would contest a leadership vote against Prime Minister Julia Gillard, bringing to a head a bitter leadership fight engulfing the minority government.
Thank you, Georgina. Now it's time for some music. This is Read All About It by Emily Sunday. Was Read All About It by Emily Sunday. Now, today is the final day of Monocle's fifth birthday week, and to round the week off, we're going to discuss Monocle's newest venture, that's Monocle Radio. Launched on October the 17th, 2011, Monocle 24 is now in its fourth month of broadcasting, and it continues, if I do say so myself, to go from strength to strength. Joining me now in the studio is Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and two of M24's producers, Katie Balboa and Paul Noble. Now, before we start to discuss the great things about Monocle 24, let's have a listen to a few of the highlights from the past few months.
Morning when we went back to bed.
Let me take you back to the beginning.
Okay.
One is getting closer and closer to Monocle House, and then the magical doors. I don't even think I was 5 feet to the door, and the doors magically opened and welcomed me. This place is incredible. You've done such an amazing job, and what a fine team you have assembled.
Thank you. Oh, by the way, we're talking to Kylie Minogue.
I remember how we met, but your name I forget, like the door that I have kept unopened.
You know, I've always had the ambition to make home furnishings that anybody can buy, you know, rather than a small, you know, the Conran shop is a small market, it doesn't reach out. Yet,
and the tape in the cassette deck was choking.
There's so much
plastic rubbish out there in terms of cookbook. A Reflex, another barbecue book, another this book, and you know, it just becomes so. That I just wanted to do something that was absolutely splat out of the heart.
I would hope that we would avoid a scenario which would be a civil war scenario, because the scenario that you are talking about is really a civil war. Is there a way to avoid that? I don't know. Should we try to avoid it? Most certainly we must.
Today on the crowded underground train, you have the numbers. Holding the cards closer than ever, you could avoid those eyes forever.
What inspired you to start designing in jelly?
Jelly is absolutely magical. It's a really, really exciting material, and it's something that, in England anyway, everyone's got a lot of nostalgia for. So it's something that people always used to have at children's parties. So everyone knows about jelly, and there's something magical about it because it's all about flavour mixing with form, and it's totally unlimited. There's so much freedom of what you can do.
In this week's show, we talk to urbanism's master, Jan Gehl, a Dane who's been busy Copenhagenizing the world's metropolises.
This word Copenhagenized, of course, has been coined by somebody who has been here and seen how it works here and have sort of come up with the idea that something like this might happen in my city.
Oh, that got a few chuckles, didn't it?
It did.
Welcome, all of you. Who has been your favourite guests?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we should have actually started a quiz, actually, and sort of name all of those famous voices.
Yeah. Mm.
Did you guess them all, Paul?
I got a couple.
Did you?
Don't ask me who.
I'll get Kylie.
Can you I got Kylie, there's absolutely.
Kylie
there.
There's yeah. There was Carl Bildt.
There was Carl Bildt. There was Terence Conran.
Who else did I hear? I heard some music from Emmy the Great and Hello Darling.
We had Allegra McEvedy, the chef.
Yeah.
So who's your favourite? Should we start with you, Katie?
Well, I'm slightly biased because I actually got to interview one of my heroes for the culture show who wasn't in that clip, called Ira Glass, who presents This American Life, which is a very successful podcast which tells stories on American public radio. And we did a storytelling special on the culture show. And so it was a real honour to talk to him. And I did get a lot of compliments as well. So, but yeah.
You get to speak to a lot of people in your culture show. We'll talk about that in more detail.
Okay.
Tyler, do you have any favourites?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of fantastic guests, but I think, you know, one of the exciting things for me has also been just all the amazing co-hosts that we've had through Studio One as well. If I think back to Launch Week, that we had Christine Okrant, who's always been just really, you know, an extraordinary icon, and it was just great to have her sitting in the seat where Katie is at the moment, and also that we worked with we had Indira Naidu, a very famous broadcaster from Australia, who was really sort of known for being sort of one of the voices and then the faces of SBS's nightly newscast. She was here for a week, so that's also been an exciting side as well. Just, you know, having, you know, all of these so far sort of great women of journalism. We can get a few men in as well as co-hosts as well.
Paul?
I'd have to say, I mean, there's, you know, some guests stick out, and it's, despite all of the global guests we brought in, it's been a lot of the British people who I've grown up listening to, particularly Peter York, Maxwell Hutchinson, and Hilary Alexander, who are all just such great guests. Mm. You know, it's an effortless interview. They come in, they start talking, they've done so much. You just have to sit back and let them do their thing. Mm-hmm.
Ben Anderson was here the other day, the documentarian.
Yeah.
That was fascinating. He wasn't all about war and violence. It was he said it was eye-opening on both sides. It's fantastic when you, like you say, speak to people that you've been aware of for so many years.
Yeah, and I think one of the strengths and the exciting things about what we've been doing as well is the variety of stories that we've been able to cover. So, you know, just the different range of topics that Monocle's kind of interested in just makes it so fascinating. When you do the live shows, you know, you'll be doing something on French bread 1 minute and then, you know, something, I don't know, on Syria the next, and then Australian politics.
Syria,
you know.
Or cereal.
Syria. Could be both.
Could be either.
Depending what shift it is. Yeah. But I think we can't leave out the fact that there was enormous excitement the day that that Kylie spent about 3 hours in the building having a curry lunch upstairs. And yeah, and then, well, we're really also becoming part of the brand that, of course, you hear many times throughout the day, and how effortless all of that was.
Yeah, apart from having Kylie as part of the image, what inspired you to create a radio station and a brand like M24?
Well, I think that it goes back to a couple of things. We do. It's not so much, you know, what do you do after your fifth year for an encore, but there is that part of it. And I think there's two things. One was, you know, what do you do for, you know, your colleagues? And I think that, you know, speaking with senior members of the editorial management and the business side, you know, we know that there's a bit of a glass ceiling here, that, you know, there's only sort of so far you can go, because hopefully I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. And also, you know, my key collaborators aren't going anywhere. So, you know, that's part of the reason why, you know, we really look to expand by opening bureaus, but also, you know, launching a new complementary media venture, of course, you know, opens up new opportunities as well. So that was one thing that was sitting, you know, I would say as something on the boardroom table, you know. And I think the other side was, it's amazing what, you know, the web delivers in terms of a very inexpensive, you know, broadcast platform. And we saw the sheer number of downloads that we had with all of the films that the Gillian and her colleagues have been working on over the years. So that was one thing. And, you know, and then we tried this little experiment about 3.5 years ago with the Monocle Weekly, which, you know, still carries on. It's still the most downloaded program that we do within the Monocle 24 schedule. And what we saw suddenly, that there was this interesting relationship, I think, that our readers, you know, had. But the other, the more interesting component was people were finding the magazine and the brand, you know, through this, as we called it, audio bulletin, because we hated to use the word podcast, and we still do. But yeah, the people were finding the brand that way. And I thought, God, you know, maybe we should expand it. And what if we did take it around the clock? And you know, would there be an opportunity to, again, do something which almost reflected, you know, and I think that was interesting, you know, the brief for Paul and Katie and everyone very early on, you know, we said, you know, how do you create a sound which is not unlike the black border of the magazine? And that has manifested itself in, you know, whether it's, you know, Kylie doing her announcement, you know, working with the Quiet Nights Orchestra in Sweden, who've done, let's say, all of the sound for Monocle 24. And then, of course, other DJs, you know, Verbal and his colleagues in Japan have remixed it. So, you know, how do you create something that's complementary? And I think what's wonderful, even sitting on a Friday, you know, evening at this point in London, there's this wonderful intimacy just being in this room, and that's the great thing, is I think people really hear that, and that's it always makes you really proud 4 months in that people feel you're having a conversation rather than shouting at them.
Did you have an idea in your head as to how it would sound?
No, I only think visually. I only thought, how is it going to look? And right. It was quite interesting because in the early days, we were having conversations with a well-respected engineering company who builds studios, etc. And they were pushing a lot of purples and, you know, they're just saying all of the wrong colors to me. Purples and reds and royal blues. And you know, this was the idea for the studios. And there was going to be surfboard-style tables out of resin. And I said, oh, no, there won't be. I said they're going to be oak and it's going to be earth. Speaking of cereals, they're all going to be sort of oatmeal tones, and that's the way it's going to be. It's going to be really ugly, mate, and blah blah blah. And then of course, you know, they say, oh God, it looks really, it's very beautiful, it's very calm in here. So yeah, I guess I always sort of thought, you know, very early on about, you know, the actual experience, because one of the curious things was, having done, I think we sort of counted, I think, you know, by the time we launched this, we had done the Monocle Weekly in about 28 different studios around the world. So we'd been to NPR in New York, and we had been at, you know, Sveriges Radio in Stockholm. So it was just wonderful research. And we thought about where do we feel most comfortable? And they were always sort of the slightly more dimly lit studios where you feel that you're almost at a dinner party. And, you know, we tried to replicate that. But I think your question about the sound as well is, we wanted something which wasn't, you know, too jarring. And I think very early on, you know, I was chatting to Paul about this, when we talked about the sound of Monocle 24, almost like the magazine. I mean, the name Monocle, you know, it's retro, and people, I mean, not, I don't see a lot of people wearing monocles anymore. But again, it was, you know, part of the creating this almost this instant mythology for the brand, that if you'd call someone in Jakarta and say, I'm calling for Monocle magazine, and maybe if they weren't, you know, particularly bright at the foreign ministry, they'd say, oh God, Monocle, you know, sounds like it's been around for a while. They must be important. And I think that there was this almost the same quality as well. I don't want to say it was retro, but I think we wanted to go back to the proper days. I would say the proper days of radio. And that's what we've tried to, of course, realizing that we're still in 2012 and we have to be, you know, modern at the same time.
And we do have the best looking studios in London,
gorgeous.
I think.
And that's actually where Quiet Nights Orchestra did such a great job with their jingles, because it's the perfect blend of retro and modern. It's, you know, there's notes of bossa nova and swinging jazz and lots of horns, but it's actually very up-to-date production techniques, and that just sets the tone for the whole station.
The live sessions, is that part of being like a traditional radio station? And did you always have in mind...
You mean the live music sessions we've done?
Yes. I mean, your new Midori House, it's a better venue for those sorts of events. And that goes hand in hand with having a radio station like this. Was it always the plan to tie that in?
We always knew there'd be some event space element. I just came from a meeting with our dear colleague on the website, Paul Regan, who's asking for more desk space already. So I fear for what's going to happen to our wonderful space downstairs, because it's one of the only places we have to grow. But you know, I would love to see that we're able to use, you know, our event space, you know, to bring in, you know, more bands. But not only that, I think, Katie, when you talk about you know, the great work of Mr. Glass and This American Life, you know, to be able to also do things in a broader form, and to be able to bring in our subscribers and listeners, and because the space works really well with a live audience. So I think, you know, as we evolve this, there should be more elements. And I think there's always been sort of a debate already, but how much do we want to be interactive? And I'm sort of very much of the view that we've gone too far in broadcasting right now, that everything is, we're always asking for people to respond constantly. I'm saying we as the media. And I think what's nice about this is, you know where to find us, and yeah, we can have an intimate conversation with you again. We will respond to your email. Doesn't mean we have to read everything out over the air. But I thought when we do venture down the track to do something interactive, then why shouldn't it again be very personal? Where you, Christian, or Katie, or Paul, or anyone, we can actually, you know, look the listeners or the participants in the eye. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really been lost, because, I mean, we've seen not just in London, but, you know, but all over the world, that, you know, a lot of the traditional radio theatres are all gone now. And it would be great to be able to bring that back.
Mm. I'd love that.
Paul, let's just go over some of the guests that we've had in the live sessions already.
Oh, now you're asking. Well,
we can do this together.
Yeah, let's do it together. I mean, we had a particularly good run at Winter when we did over Christmas. We did the Winter series, and we had Beverly Knight, who was phenomenal. And bear in mind, this is, you know, on our ground floor next to our canteen during a kitchen lunch break. So people are essentially working... sitting there tapping away, wander down, and suddenly having their hearts ripped out by a, you know, belting powerhouse performance.
And then there was Hanson. Great. Never forget Hanson.
Hanson, I mean, it was on par with Kylie, levels of hysteria in the building. In certain quarters.
Then we've had Charlene Spiteri. She performed at Christmas time.
Yeah, we had Tuomo.
Exactly, from Finland.
Very good.
Do you have a wish list that you've built up, people that you're targeting?
I've got a small list for the culture show of people
you?
I've got my eye on.
Go on, indulge us.
I don't want to give too much away, to be honest. You kind of look out for what international artists to come into London and see what, you know, who you like to get in and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I think it's always good to be ambitious as well. And
I'll give away my wish list.
Go on.
Pet Shop Boys, Kanye West.
Are you vetoing any of those times?
No, not at all. I would love to. I would like to see if we could get Saint-Étienne in to do something with us. As well. And you know, almost, you know, I don't want to say, because we have been hugely ambitious, but, you know, I think back to also the people when we've done sort of the Monocle Summer Series, etc. You know, when we had, you know, Bryan Adams sitting in a space with no more nets and wires than just a chair and a microphone, and him doing an acoustic session and just, you know, singing at the table. And I, you know, I think that we've just been so busy with many other things that maybe there hasn't been as much, you know, lobbying and pitching with the labels or the agents. But, you know, I think we can weave it in more. And, you know, there's, you know, we've had to spend the last 4 months also really setting a tone and showing, you know, why we're, you know, not other radio services around the world, and that we also are able to mix, you know, very serious topics, you know, across, well, now 6-7 hours of the day, but also with, you know, live music and of course, you know, all of the, you know, the recorded sets that we have as well, in addition to all of, you know, the feature programs. And so, you know, it's actually quite, you know, quite a unique mix, because I think even if you look at some of the, or listen to some of the very respected public service broadcasters, you know, in the United States, you know, they've also segmented now. So you just have, you know, you have the 24-hour and, you know, or let's say the 24-hour National Public Radio, you know, affiliate station, which is just news. Then they've got one which is just, you know, classical music, and then one which is just jazz. And I think it's actually nice just to mix it all up, and you never quite know what you're going to get. But at least there'll be a degree of consistency in tone.
Clearly, the eclectic feel is what you're hoping to continue. How do you look forward? Last question for all of you. What plans can you consider for the future of Monocle 24 without drifting towards familiar territory that we're already used to?
Paul, you first.
Well, I mean, I think there's room for more shows. There's probably room for a film show. There's probably room for a media show. There's some specialist music shows, which I'd certainly like to develop. So, you know, we've got what we've got, and it's up and running, and it's sounding great. And then we can just look at building up the schedule beyond this.
Yeah, I mean, formats that we haven't explored yet, I think there's so much room for potential. The idea of using the space more for some interaction and programmes like that, I think would be amazing. Also, I'd like to personally like to look at doing more longer form documentaries and things like that.
So. And I think we touched on that last night, because when we had Gillian here, we were listening to so many of the films we were doing. There was just a wonderful piece that she played that was one of Rob's reports from the Biennale, the Venice Art Biennale. And it just worked beautifully. Just listening to this piece of video on radio, it was Rob's wonderful script with just a lovely soundtrack underneath. And I thought I could have listened to that for over an hour. And I think, as Katie's saying, I think to be able to work on longer formats, to have, you know, weeks of just, you know, great theme specials, etc., would be good. And, you know, slowly every day, we gain another minute or another 30 seconds that we're a little bit more on top of things, you know, which is good. But I think that, you know, probably like everything in the Northern Hemisphere, I imagine, we'll probably see something of a, I wouldn't say relaunch, but definitely a new season, you know, come end of August or early September.
And I think one of our great strengths is the assumption that our audience are intelligent and, you know, don't just want things in tiny chunks and are prepared to sit back and listen for a bit. Mm. So I'd like to just build on that as much as possible.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak to all of you. Katie Bilboa and Paul Noble, Monocle 24 producers, thank you. And Tyler, you'll be staying with me. We'll have a short break now, but Tyler will be staying with us to look through issues 41 to 51 of Monocle. We'll also be joined by Steve Bloomfield. Stay with us.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
It's 18:53 here in London now, every day this week. We've been picking our favourite articles from past copies of Monocle. Today we're looking at the past year of Monocle, issues 41 to 50. Tyler, start us off. Tell us about the fifth anniversary issue.
Well, the fifth anniversary issue is one which, yeah, really looks at Australia, and it's incredible in these last few weeks, actually, how the fifth anniversary issue, which is number 51, has... The Aussies have certainly loved it, and there's going to be a piece coming up in the Australian. It's supposed to be coming up next Monday. I think it's going to be a week on Monday. But, you know, when you give people a little bit of attention, and in Steve's section, you know, we had the good fortune that Andrew Muller, who I'm going to be hosting the Monocle Daily with this evening, had an interview with Kevin Rudd. And
a very timely one.
Yeah, very timely one. And, of course, we asked him, you know, by the time this comes out, you know, will you still be the foreign minister? You know, to which he says yes. And, of course, that didn't come to pass. And what's interesting is I there is something of a curse of of Monocle, that there have been a number of high profile interviews that we've done with, you know, various captains of industries, etc., and some not particularly nice things have happened shortly after. Two airlines come to mind, but I won't go into details. People can go back and look at those issues and see what happened some weeks after we did those interviews. But anyway, nevertheless, we do want people to be able to sit down and talk to us. But yeah, we're very Aussie themed for everyone who's seen issue 51. But if I sort of look back on over the past year, one that really stands out for me is our May issue, which was issue 43, so May 2011. And the headline was, you know, how do you jumpstart Japan, reigniting the rising sun? And we really jumped in very deep, you know, in the wake of the events of March 11th of last year, and tried to deliver a very, you know, proactive piece and across, you know, the entire issue. You know, we looked at various elements of you know, how do you reignite this place called Japan, and looked, you know, at a variety of sort of, you know, very interesting stories and sectors, and tried to be very, I think, also proactive. And one of the great pieces that, that we did was, and, you know, anyone who likes or is keen on media, was the piece we did on NHK, because of course, you know, people who are in media, of course, know that NHK is the public broadcaster of Japan, but. You know, we just, and it was amazing to sort of watch this network and the power that NHK had last year, because, you know, suddenly, you know, you realize it was the difference of, okay, you know, this, you know, horrible, you know, disaster which happened in daylight hours, but yet it was brought to you with the muscle of a public service broadcaster. And we sort of broke it down in numbers. And, you know, it would make, you know, the when you look at sort of the equipment and what NHK has, it would make, you know, any other broadcaster weep. 74 satellite trucks, 14 helicopters, you know, 691 cameras, 1,100 correspondents, you know, 380 cameramen, 173 studios. And you realize that every single night in Japan, they stage a mock broadcast every night after the main bulletin goes off air, both in Tokyo and Osaka. And I know, to me, that was just great journalism. And it was, I think we're the only type of magazine that would do something like that.
I think you're right. And, the other thing I particularly liked in this issue on the Japan theme as well was our star leader of Naoto Kan. And, you know, the star leader, you know, I think often works very well, but here it was perfect because, you know, we'd all seen Naoto Kan in his sort of blue overalls that become sort of the uniform of, you know, Japan's leaders during this crisis. And we had Fiona Wilson, our Asia Bureau chief, really sort of breaking down what it all meant. And, you know, even from his face and sort of, you know, how you're supposed to look when your country's in crisis. And of course, that issue as well had our design directory. And if I can give a minor plug as well, there's a small story
oh,
at the front
about
Doha and Qatar, right. Which I think was definitely well worth reading. One of my favourites from earlier this year was, or favourite stories, was in issue 42, our April issue. And this was our story on Baghdad, which I just think was, we made it look beautiful. I mean, Sebastian Meyer did a fantastic job with photography. Shashank Bengali wrote a really fantastic piece. We ran it over 9 pages, and it was just a really good, it was the sort of story that I think other magazines wouldn't do.
You could have gone on for a lot longer.
Oh, we could have gone on. So I know. We rattled on at radio for so long. We didn't want to talk about the print, but I think we're at the end of the program.
Tyler Brulé and Steve Bloomfield, thank you ever so much. Sadly, we are out of time for this Friday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Bacheo, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. Next is Monocle's food program, The Menu.